This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 1st of April, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, violence in Libya forces thousands of people to flee. We'll go to a camp on Tunisia's border and speak to refugees.
They'll call you, make a line, then they'll start searching you one by one.
In Washington, lawmakers pass a bill to curtail the collective bargaining rights of federal aviation and rail workers.
It's so important to the Republicans to end the labor movement, and they feel Ohio is they've taken us as the bullseye.
And we'll take a look at the link between No Child Left Behind and the rising number of arrests and juvenile detentions. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Anti-government demonstrators in Yemen today held what has been described as the largest protest yet, calling for the immediate resignation of President Ali Abdullah Saleh. A rival demonstration in support of the longtime ruler drew approximately 10,000 people, according to the Associated Press. Saleh declared a state of emergency 2 weeks ago in an effort to quell the protests. Demonstrations also took place in cities and towns across Syria. Security forces there have met protesters with deadly force on several occasions. Reports vary, putting the number of dead from today's protests at between 3 and 10. Media reports often rely on eyewitness testimony, but this online amateur video shows the use of live ammunition against unarmed Syrian protesters. The footage shows bleeding protesters lying on the ground with bullet wounds to the face and chest. At least 60 protesters have been killed since demonstrations began in mid-March. One of the top grievances is the restrictive emergency rule that has been in place for nearly 50 years. Many had hoped that President Bashar al-Assad would announce major reforms to the law when he addressed Parliament on Wednesday. Instead, he suggested it could be a matter of a committee study and blamed the protests on foreign conspiracies. In a follow-up to a story reported yesterday, prominent Bahraini blogger Mahmoud al-Yusif was released late Thursday after the U.S. State Department criticized his arrest. The blogger is known for promoting the phrase, "No Shia, no Sunni, just Bahraini," in reference to the sectarian divisions that have split the small country. An estimated 300 protesters remain in custody. A United Nations working group investigating forced disappearances has wrapped up a two-week fact-finding mission in Mexico. Among their preliminary recommendations are the suggestions the Mexican government consider the withdrawal of the armed forces from public security operations and establish a national registry to document cases of forced disappearances. Currently, the bulk of documentation of forced disappearances in Mexico is carried out by regional non-governmental human rights organizations. The working group noted that distrust of the authorities often prevents citizens from documenting cases with governmental entities. And finally, a court in Argentina handed down sentences to four former military officers for their participation in the human rights abuses carried out under military rule from 1976 to 1983. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
A federal court sentenced former General Eduardo Cabanillas to life in prison for directing the notorious Altomotores Orleti Detention Center. Three other officers were convicted of illegal imprisonment. Outside the courthouse, hundreds of human rights activists celebrated the verdict. Giselle Temper from the human rights group Hijos says that Argentina has set an example for other countries to revisit their history and show that it's possible to address the impunity that has surrounded major crimes of human rights abuses for decades. The Orleti Secret Detention Center was a symbol of the Plan Condor, a shared strategy in Latin America's southern region during the 1970s and 80s that received support from Washington. Human rights groups estimate that at least 300 were detained, tortured, and forcefully disappeared from the center. Argentina has taken the lead regionally in trying former military and police figures after amnesty laws were overturned in 2005. Uruguay and Brazil still uphold amnesty laws, which protect former security officers from charges related to human rights violations. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
And those are some of today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In Libya, there's growing evidence of civilian casualties from NATO-led airstrikes. A doctor from Ajibaya has told the BBC that he was called to a village a few kilometres from Brega following a coalition airstrike against a Gaddafi convoy. Dr. Suleiman Refadi said one of the shells struck a truck and trailer containing ammunition parked between two houses. It exploded, killing 7 people and injuring about 25. The dead included 3 girls from the same family and 3 teenage boys. But the doctor said the relatives of the dead wanted airstrikes to continue because they were stopping Gaddafi's forces from killing even more civilians in their village and other towns and cities. In Benghazi, an opposition leader has called for a ceasefire. Mustafa Abdul Jalil, head of the interim governing council, said the condition for a ceasefire would be the withdrawal of Gaddafi's forces from Libyan cities. Meanwhile, Gaddafi's forces continue to shell the western town of Misrata and, according to Associated Press, are in control of the city's port and main street. In the east, both sides are fighting for control over the oil town of Brega. An Al Jazeera correspondent said the rebels are not only outgunned, but according to American military intelligence, outnumber the rebels by 10 to 1. But a BBC correspondent in Brega says the rebel forces there are being helped by the recent arrival of a number of well-armed soldiers. He couldn't say the origin of those troops. The violence in Libya has forced more than 400,000 people to flee the country, according to the International Organization for Migration. About half of these refugees have sought shelter in Tunisia. While most of the foreign workers have been repatriated to their home countries, some 5,000 migrants remain stranded in the transit camps along Tunisia's border with Libya, and hundreds more are arriving every day. From the Tunisian-Libyan border, Marine Olivesi reports.
Finding one's way through Shusha camp isn't easy. About 4,000 white hoop tents have mushroomed in a landscape of sand and small bushes. But there's one tent every migrant at Shusha knows, the phone tent. Huda is a young Tunisian volunteer. She explains the tent was set up to help displaced migrants reconnect with their families. Courtesy of the Red Cross, they're allowed 1 3-minute phone call every day. Huda says those 13 cell phones are these migrants' lifelines and the best moral booster there is. Emerging from the tent with a large grin on is Mustafa. This Ghanaian father of two worked for a couple of years as a painter in Tripoli. He just crossed the border and delivered the good news to his wife.
They are very happy to hear my voice. This is the first time I talk to them. So at this time I speak to my wife. She's very, very happy. She's now on her way to going to tell my mother that she hear my voice. On the day I call her that I'm in the prison.
Mustafa says his mother will be relieved. The last time he called her was from a Libyan prison. He explains that on March 11, the Libyan police barged into his house and rounded him up along with other Ghanaians living with him. None of them knew why they were arrested. That's when Mustafa decided to leave Libya for good. He says the Ghanaian embassy in Tripoli helped arrange the release after 20 days in jail and put them in a bus to Tunisia. But the ordeal wasn't over. Mustafa's bus hit several roadblocks on the way out. He says he can't really tell who stripped them of their belongings, whether they were policemen or armed civilians, but their search was thorough.
They'll call you, make a line, then they'll start searching you one by one. I have 3 mobile phones. My Ghana SIM card self, they collect and destroy it. This one, I hide it here. On my slippers here.
You hide it under your foot?
Here, under my foot. I have most important numbers on this. If I lost this phone, I lost everything.
Migrants at Shusha have plenty of similar stories to tell. Stories too long for a 3-minute call, so they skip the details and go straight to what matters. They've made it out of Libya. Waiting for his turn in front of the tent, Ahmed won't be the one delivering the news. He's not calling to say he's safe, but to inquire on whether his family still is.
Ouais, je vais appeler mon frère. Mon frère qui était tout actuellement en Côte d'Ivoire. Je vais l'appeler pour voir sa situation, comment ça va. Est-ce qu'il fait des soucis pour nous, mais pour le moment, nous.
Ahmed says his sister and three brothers are locked down in a house in Abidjan, in Ivory Coast. He says last time he called, his older brother told him they were running out of food. With Alassane Ouattara's supporter closing in on the capital, violence has escalated in the past few days. Ahmed says he's better off at Choucha camp because at least he's safe here. Reassured about his family back home after he talked to his brother, Ahmed opens up about his own recent experience with civil war in Libya. He worked for over a year as a welder in Tadjoura, a district of Tripoli. He fled on March 22nd after the coalition's airstrikes started hitting Tadjoura.
We heard bombings at 2 in the morning. You're asleep, and then you hear, boom. But you're not even a Libyan. You're an Ivorian. You can't possibly die in Libya. You go here to make a living. If things turn ugly, you've got to go back home.
Yet it's a long way home for Ahmed and the 80 other Ivorians at Choucha camp. With the situation escalating in Ivory Coast, they're now considered refugees. And the UN Refugee Agency is looking into options for their relocation. In the meantime, Ahmed goes back to the phone tent every morning to check on his family, stranded in the midst of another civil war over 2,000 miles away. Marine Olivesi, Free Speech Radio News, Tunisia.
Ohio Governor John Kasich has signed Senate Bill 5, a law which strongly curtails collective bargaining rights for state and local employees and weakens labor's influence in the workplace. Union leaders hope to block the bill from taking effect through a referendum this November. From Columbus, Sevilla Mann has more.
Governor Kasich seemed to downplay the idea of an agenda against unions behind Senate Bill 5 when he addressed the small audience gathered for the signing Thursday evening.
You know, this is not an effort to punish anybody. This is an effort, again, to restore balance. So, this is a, you know, not particularly a happy day. This is just one more step in a march to make sure that we can save Ohio.
Also attending the signing was House Speaker William Batchelder. His comments suggested a long-standing desire on the part of some lawmakers to change the 1983 law which gave state workers the right to collectively bargain.
This is a kind of an amazing evening in some ways for those of us who served here in 1983 when the original bill was passed. It went through the Senate in one heck of a hurry. It got to the House and was held up for a while. I thought perhaps there was going to be an effort to change some of the language because it was so overreaching.
A few minutes later, Kasich signed the bill.
It's now law. Senate Bill 5 is now law.
Senate Bill 5 may now be law, but it's not in effect yet, and opponents have a strategy to challenge it. They hope they'll stop the bill from ever going on the books. Bill Liebensberger is the vice president of the Ohio Education Association.
Once the bill is signed, the clock starts for the bill to become law within 90 days. But also during that 90-day window is the opportunity to collect signatures to petition that the issue be put on the ballot for a citizen veto of the bill. And the question on that ballot will be, shall Senate Bill 5 become law?
If Ohioans were to vote no, then Senate Bill 5 would never take effect. Opponents of Senate Bill 5 have to gather more than 230,000 signatures in the next 90 days to place the issue on the ballot this November. Union leaders say they aren't worried about reaching that number, and Liebensberger says he feels cautiously optimistic that Ohioans would vote no on a referendum.
Right now, public opinion is very clearly in favor of our position, which would be not in support of Senate Bill 5. Most people understand the inherent fairness of working people having a voice in their working conditions.
But Senate Bill 5's supporters don't plan to just stand by while unions campaign to repeal it. Mark Horton is the Secretary Treasurer of the Ohio Association of Professional Firefighters.
My concern is now that the money is going to come in from outside of Ohio, outside sources in millions of dollars, and we feel it'll probably be on the level of a presidential election for this because it's so important to the Republicans to end the labor movement, and they feel Ohio is the they've taken us as the bullseye.
Others share this concern, including high school social studies teacher Philip Hayes. He points to the conservative group FreedomWorks and their $5 million campaign to attack unions.
They've even created their own ad, a 30-second spot, that portrays me, a high school social studies teacher, a kindergarten teacher, a nurse, a firefighter, a police officer, as bullies. That's unconscionable. I'm not a bully. You know, I make sure students don't bully each other, but I don't bully anyone.
Ohio unions certainly feel they have much to lose if the new law does eventually go into effect. The curtailment of collective bargaining powers for issues beyond wages and hours is only one aspect of Senate Bill 5's impact. The final bill also allows the government to pick its own last best offer if negotiations stall on a particular contract. Non-union members will no longer have to pay so-called fair share fees to the union, which negotiates and enforces their contracts. And previously, an employee could use a payroll deduction to make contributions to a union political action committee. That will no longer be allowed under Senate Bill 5. Mark Horton says an amendment which addressed the question of public safety workers negotiating for equipment didn't go far enough.
With the bargaining process and the dispute resolution that they put in place, you're bargaining with someone that essentially means that if they say no, that's the end of it. There is no other redress. There's nothing else we can do about that. By telling people we can bargain over safety equipment, it says that in actuality, it's not going to work.
Unions plan a kickoff event for launching the referendum effort next weekend. A Republican-run website, sb5truth.com, has made a call for volunteers, and Governor Kasich asked for donations in an email to supporters Thursday morning to, as he put it, help us continue to return the balance of power. Sevilla Mann, Free Speech Radio News, Columbus.
Today, lawmakers in the U.S. House of Representatives passed a Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization bill that Democrats say cuts billions from the FAA's budget and also keeps controversial language that critics have called anti-labor, because it makes it harder for unions to organize. A statement from the White House indicates President Obama would veto a bill that curbs collective bargaining rights. Michael Lawson has more.
While the larger budget war continues on Capitol Hill, a smaller battle was won by House Republicans Friday. The House passed a $60 billion FAA reauthorization bill by a vote of 223 to 196, largely along party lines. The bill calls for $4.1 billion in cuts through 2014. The FAA has operated without an official budget since 2003. A provision in the bill would repeal a rule by the National Mediation Board used in collective bargaining elections. The new rule counts all the ballots cast and requires a majority of yes votes to adopt unionization. It replaced out a 75-year-old provision that counted workers who didn't cast ballots as voting no for unionization. The provision only made it into the bill by one vote in committee, with three Republicans voting on an amendment that would have struck the language. Republican Congressmember Steve LaTourette of Ohio introduced Amendment 21 to the House floor, which would have struck the provision from the final bill. He defended his decision to break from his party on the House floor Thursday.
The president said he won't sign this bill unless this amendment is adopted. The Senate has declared this a non-starter. And so if we want to give fancy speeches, and for those just tuning in around the country, you know, welcome to Wacky Union Night, because this will be our fourth, fifth anti-union vote that has nothing to do with the aviation system.
According to LaTourette, the decision by the National Mediation Board was made following the request of 191 members of Congress and several hearings. Congressmember John Mica, chair of the House Transportation Infrastructure Committee, called LaTourette's amendment the height of unfairness. Mica accused the Obama administration of influencing the board's decision to further unions over individuals.
This is not fair by any means. We should allow unionization. We should allow votes of it. But those, again, who are affected, who have to pay the dues, who have to abide by the union rules and regulations that they set, it's not fair.
In addition to the labor issues, a White House statement issued Wednesday says the House's spending cuts would, quote, degrade safe and efficient air travel. According to Transportation and Infrastructure Ranking Member Nick Rahal, a Democrat, the House bill would eliminate 70,000 jobs and hurt small airports. Pat Garofalo is with the Center for American Progress Action Fund.
Aside from this labor provision and aside from the budget cuts, there are all sorts of kind of little niche issues in these sorts of bills that people get really bent out of shape about.
Garofalo says while the labor provision and the deficit-reducing aspirations of the current Congress are the subject of debate now, these issues are actually cropping up at the end.
What really hung this up for so long was much smaller parochial stuff. It wasn't your typical partisan, you know, Republicans versus Democrats. It was very much regional, Midwest versus Northeast versus South versus who gets to fly in and out of Washington, D.C.
The Senate has already passed its own version of the bill in February that had no labor language and actually raised spending. House and Senate leaders must now negotiate to merge the two versions of the bill. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
As Congress prepares to reform the No Child Left Behind Act, public interest advocates are linking the program to increased rates of arrests and detentions of youth, and primarily youth of color and who have disabilities. A new report, published by a coalition of advocacy groups, says school suspension and expulsion rates are at all-time highs and have risen dramatically since 2002, the year NCLB took effect. Black students are now more than three times more likely to be suspended from school than whites. The NAACP's Legal Defense and Educational Practice was one of the contributors to the report, and Damon Hewitt is the director. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much, Denny.
Tell us about the correlation between No Child Left Behind and the increased use of law enforcement and referrals to the juvenile and criminal justice system.
The No Child Left Behind Act, which reauthorized the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, had some very good intentions, exposing racial disparities in the achievement and academics of various racial ethnic subgroups. However, the statute's inordinate focus on standardized tests has had some pretty serious consequences. Some may say they're unintended consequences, but nonetheless, the focus on tests actually provides a perverse incentives for schools to push students out when they are less likely to succeed or less likely to perform well academically, or if they present challenging behavior. It's much easier for schools to push those students out of school, counsel them into GED programs, to send them to alternative schools, or to simply suspend and expel them out of school in an effort to focus on the quote-unquote good kids, those who are most likely to succeed.
So it pushes the children out. How does the law specifically encourage more law enforcement and harsh discipline actually in the schools themselves?
Well, essentially the focus on testing is a significant problem, but there's also this category of what we call persistently dangerous schools. This notion that if a school has some type of problem with safety, that what we'll do as a country is simply label the school instead of to actually address the problems therein. This has provided an incentive for school districts and individual schools and school leaders to use exclusionary discipline policies. The statute as it stands now does not require any tracking, assessment, or accountability based upon these types of excesses. And so they can run rampant and they can run completely unchecked.
How many students do you think this is affecting, and who's documenting these exclusions? And you also say it leads inevitably to arrests and detentions.
Right. The numbers are astounding. About 30 years ago, nationwide, about 1.7 million students were suspended out of school each year. Today, that number has doubled to over 3.4 million, and that far outpaces the increases in student population nationwide. Also, we know hundreds of thousands of students are also expelled out of school each year. So the numbers are astounding, and the racial disparities have actually continued to widen. Whereas 20 years ago, African-American students were twice as likely as their white peers to be suspended out of school. Today, they're three times as likely to be suspended and three and a half times as likely to be expelled. The NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, along with many of its colleagues and other organizations have documented these type of statistics and published reports, and the numbers are simply indisputable. Even the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights has documented the same alarming statistics, and a growing contingent of advocates is very concerned.
So this is exactly what's called the school-to-prison pipeline, and these large numbers of children being expelled must have a pretty strong effect on families and communities. Can you tell us how it's impacting?
Well, the effect on families and communities is devastating. We had a client recently who was a homecoming queen for her high school. She was alleged to have improperly had a cell phone on campus, which is banned on her high school campus. And in response, she was suspended out of school for 5 days and assigned to alternative school for 45 days and stripped of her homecoming crown. That is a knee-jerk, inappropriate, disproportionate response if I've ever heard of one. Sadly, this happens all the time in school districts all around the country. And when we reached out to the parents, or when they reached out to us, rather, we were horrified at the story, and we simply had to, read it and listen for ourselves just so we could really believe it. But this happens all the time, and there is a lack of legal resources out there to assist individual parents, individual families whose children are faced with these successive, repeat, serial suspensions and expulsions for nonviolent, minor misbehavior.
The Obama administration and Congress will be considering changes to the No Child Left Behind policy. What are their key proposals?
Well, right now, we don't like what we're hearing, Denny. Some of the key proposals we've heard is an increased flexibility for states, which could be important. There are many valid critiques of No Child Left Behind in terms of its inflexibility. But we are very concerned about a proposed rollback of federally mandated accountability and federal interventions when schools do fail in terms of academics, in terms of graduation rates, and in terms of excessive imposition of these exclusionary discipline practices. The ESEA and the No Child Left Behind Act are really at their heart civil rights statutes. And if we're going to recognize and realize the civil rights core, the human rights core of this important landmark legislation, we have to maintain a federal role in accountability. We've allowed the states significant latitude for many decades to get this right on their own. And they've shown us, except for a few examples and a few instances, that they cannot do it on their own. They need federal guidance, they need federal interventions, and they need federal assistance, technical assistance, financial resources, and human capital to actually guide them to the right path. So we're calling upon the Obama administration and congressional leaders to retain the key civil rights principles in this legislation and to develop a more robust and broader vision of accountability that isn't simply focused on standardized tests.
Damon Hewitt from the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, thanks very much for speaking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you, Denny.
And that's the program for today and this week. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Shannon Young. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Michael Lawson. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. Visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.